maybe it's worth starting out by Angelo yesterday gave a nice introduction to the measurement problem. Maybe it's worth having the explicit mathematical form of the problem concretely on the board before we start. So here's a way of stating the measurement problem. If you have some, say, measuring device for X spin that starts out in its ready state. So that's the state of the measuring device, and you confront it with a particle in an eigenstate of Z spin. Okay. And you suppose that the X-spin measuring device is a properly functioning measuring device for X-spin. So what that means is you suppose that if you confront it with an X-spin up eigenstate, it'll end up indicating up. And if you confront it with an X-spin down eigenstate, it'll end up indicating down. If those two are the case, if everything is governed by the linear dynamical quantum mechanical equations of motion, then you get just by linearity that in this case, since the Z-spin eigenstate can be written as a superposition of two X-spin eigenstates, so since this can be rewritten in this way, since this can be written this way, it's a straightforward consequence of the linearity of the equations of motion that this evolves into a state like this. I'll call this state indicates that up times up X spin plus 1 over root 2 indicates that down for the measuring device, down for the X spin. Good. And the trouble with this result, of course, is that on the standard way of thinking about what it means to be in a superposition, this represents a physical situation in which there fails to be a fact about where the pointer is pointing, a situation in which asking where the pointer is pointing is like asking, say, about the marital status of the number 5 or about the weight in grams of Catholicism or something like that. So this is a situation in which they're straight, in which on the standard way of thinking about what it means to be in a superposition, there straightforwardly fails to be any fact about where the pointer is pointing, about how the measurement has come out. And the trouble here is that, of course, that is in as straightforward way as is imaginable in conflict with our empirical experience of the world, in which at the end of such procedures, there invariably is some fact about where the pointer is pointing, and there is some fact about how the experiment came out. That is, the situation that we usually observe at the end of one of these experiments is either this with 50% probability or this with 50% probability, but never this. Good. I take it all of this is familiar to everybody. There are three main realistic, philosophically realistic strategies that have grown up as along the lines of attempts to respond to the measurement problem. Bell famously said that what the measurement problem shows us is that either the Schrodinger equation in the non-relativistic case, either the Schrodinger equation isn't everything or it isn't right. And those two alternatives describe two of these three attempts to solve the problem. That is, the thought that it isn't, that is, here are the two traditional attempts in a very sketchy way at solving the measurement problem. One, you hang on to the claim that the wave function is a complete description of the physical system, and you try to solve the problem by trying to deny that this is what it evolves into, okay? By adding nonlinear terms to the equations of motion, by producing something like a collapse of the wave function. These are the strategies that Angelo described in lots of detail to us yesterday. That's one class of attempts to solve the measurement problem. Second class of attempts to solve the measurement problem is to hang on to the claim that the Schrodinger equation is always correct as a description of the evolution of the wave function in time, and to deny the claim that the wave function is a complete description of the physical system, okay? This is the tradition of, hidden variables is a very bad word once you see any of these theories, but this is the tradition of additional variables or extra variables, the most notable example of which that we have at the moment is Bohmian mechanics, okay? And then there's a third tradition, not one of the two that's envisioned in Bell's remark, okay? A tradition in which what you aspire to do is hang on both to the claim that the Schrodinger equation accurately describes the evolution of the wave function under all circumstances, and to the claim that the wave function is a complete description of physical reality. This is the tradition that starts with Everett and that has come to be called things like the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, the many histories interpretation of quantum mechanics, so on and so forth. What it seems to me right to say, although this is very controversial, is that it's pretty clear that at least in the non-relativistic case, we have workable solutions to the measurement problem of the first two kinds, okay? That is, of the two kinds that Bell envisioned, of the collapse variety and of the additional variables variety. It's less clear that we have a workable solution in the Everett tradition, and the main worry there, which I won't go into at all today, has to do with the business of trying to make sense of the probabilistic locutions we use in quantum mechanics, trying to make sense of claims that quantum mechanics predicts that you know, certain ensembles of experiments ought to have certain outcomes of certain ensembles of experiments ought to have certain relative frequencies. Anyway, that's the sort of landscape that I'm aware of. Of attempts to solve the measurement problem. I'm going to zero in on the first here and on one particular example of the first, that is the collapse strategy. The strategy where you want to hang on to the claim that the wave function is a complete description of physical reality, but solve the problem by denying the claim that the standard linear unitary equations of motion are the ones that actually govern, under all circumstances, the evolution of the wave function. There are a bunch of ways of realizing that strategy. There's a whole taxonomy of different ways of realizing that strategy, which were very nicely laid out for us yesterday again by Angelo. I just want to focus on the simplest example that we have of this kind of strategy, the original GRW theory. Let me just add, and maybe we can come back to this later, what I'm going to say about the connection between the GRW theory and the foundations of statistical mechanics, I think is going to go through in exactly the same way for theories like CSL, the originator of which is here with us today, Philip, who's going to be talking later, and most of the other theories on the chart of collapse theories that Angelo presented us with yesterday, with the notable exception of Penrose's theory. Penrose's theory falls into an importantly different category vis-a-vis the kinds of considerations that I want to talk about today, and we'll come back to that later. Anyway, let me just start off with a very simple GRW theory. I think everybody here is familiar with how the theory works. The idea is this. You modify the Schrodinger equation in the following way. You stipulate that superimposed on top of this linear evolution, there's this stochastic process going on, okay? Whereby every now and then, with a certain fixed probability per unit time, per elementary particle in the original version of the GRW theory, the wave function that's evolving in accord with the Schrodinger equation, all of a sudden, for no particular reason, and it's really important that it's for no particular reason, that is, there's no physical trigger of this process in the GRW theory. Every now and then, it gets multiplied by another function, which in the three coordinates of some particular one of the particles has the form of a Gaussian, and which is uniform in all the other dimensions. Which one of the particles gets picked out to be the one that gets multiplied by the Gaussian is random. And essentially the rule is that the probability of the Gaussians being centered at a certain particular point in the three-dimensional space is roughly equal to the standard Born rule probability of finding that particle at that particular location in old-fashioned quantum mechanics if you were to do a measurement of the position of that particle. I'm going over this extremely quickly because I take it everybody is familiar with this theory. Yes?
Actually, it's not proportional to Born's rule, it's proportional to the power of normalization constant. Like
you mean to the inner product between the Gaussian? Yeah. I it seems to me, actually, it's a good question. Is there, would it make a, is there, I mean, of course it would make a small difference in the actual evolution of the wave function, but is there a strong reason for doing it the second way as opposed to the first way?
Well, the reason is that if you do it by, they take a linear product, then you can prove by induction that Born's rule always works. Like if Born's rule works after that event, then Born's
rule. And it wouldn't do it, and it wouldn't do it. That's interesting. Let's discuss this more.
It's the only way you get a Lindblad equation.
Yeah. Right. Good. That's a good answer. Good. I stand corrected. Good. So the probability is proportional to the product of this Gaussian with the pre-existing wave function. Okay.
Is it an inner product or just a simple product?
That sounds like a trick question. We have it in the position representation. It's a simple, inner product is a simple product integrated over space. They're the same thing. Good. And as everybody knows, the two features of this process that you want to highlight are one, that this process has almost no effect whatsoever on the evolutions of the wave functions of isolated systems consisting of relatively small numbers of elementary particles, that is the kinds of systems for which we're confident that the Schrodinger equation, for which we're empirically confident that the Schrodinger equation is always correct. That's just because the rate of collapse per particle, the probability per unit time per particle of one of these collapses is enormously small. So that there's prima facie good reason to hope that this is going to hold in place the claims about the evolutions of wave functions of relatively microscopic systems, which for which we have very strong empirical reasons to believe that the Schrodinger equation is true. But on the other end of the spectrum, if you consider if you consider states which are superpositions of some macroscopic object, like this notebook being over here and being over here, Superpositions like that will be extremely short-lived in this theory, okay? The amount of time you have to wait is just the amount of time until some single one of the elementary particles that comprise this notebook happen to get hit by one of these collapses, okay? Because if one of them happens to get hit by a collapse which localizes it here, that's gonna multiply the entire state corresponding to the notebook being over here by zero, or rather by a very small number corresponding to the size of the exponential tail of the Gaussian. That's gonna snap the entire notebook suddenly into being localized over here. Okay, so as simple as this proposal is, it has the very beautiful property of having almost no effect in those situations where we don't want it to have an effect, and having a very dramatic and very rapid effect in those situations where we do want it to, where we do want it to have an effect. Okay. Good. Shift gears completely. Let's talk about the foundations of statistical mechanics. Suppose somebody would like to know what the proper scientific account is of the fact that, say, a block of ice placed on the floor of a warm room tends, if you come back in 20 minutes, what you have is a puddle, okay? The standard explanation goes like this. The standard statistical mechanical explanation goes like this. The macro description, there's a block of ice sitting on the floor of a warm room, is consistent with an enormous number of different exact microscopic conditions of the system under description, okay? That is, there is an infinite set of points in the phase space corresponding to the system consisting of a room and a block of ice that are compatible with the macro description. There's a block of ice sitting on the floor in the middle of a room at such and such an air temperature. And some of those microstates are sitting on, talk classically here. Some of those microstates are sitting on deterministic Newtonian trajectories, which are gonna evolve the system to a puddle 20 minutes down the road. And some of those microstates are sitting on deterministic Newtonian trajectories, which are not gonna take it to a puddle 10 minutes down the road, in which there's still gonna be a block of ice sitting there, or in which the block of ice has gotten larger, or in which the block of ice has turned into a giraffe, or all sorts of different things. I don't know whether there's actually one where the block of ice turns into a giraffe, but there are surely microstates in that set where all kinds of crazy stuff happens. Certainly stuff very much at odds with the expectations produced by the laws of thermodynamics, okay? Good. And what we're in need of, and this is sort of what the foundations of statistical mechanics is all about, what we're in need of is some excuse for neglecting some excuse for not worrying about the second class of microstates that I just mentioned, okay? The ones that are sitting on Newtonian trajectories which lead you elsewhere than to a puddle on the floor 20 minutes down the road, okay? And what happens in statistical mechanics, so there's a long, long history, which I don't want to drag us through here, although maybe there'll be a need to discuss some of it depending on what questions arise. There's a long, long history of trying to explain clearly the grounds on which we feel safe in neglecting the so-called crazy microstates, okay? The non-thermodynamic microstates that I just mentioned. And The upshot of all this discussion, the standard upshot of all this discussion, is something like this. There is a nice, there are of course an infinite number of measures you can put on a space of points in phase space like this. But there's a particularly nice measure, there's a particularly simple measure, the standard Lebesgue measure over points in phase space, such that if you regard that measure as giving you the probability that any particular one of those microstates is actually realized, given the information, conditional on the information that the macro state you described is realized. Okay. There is a simple measure you can adopt as a probability distribution over the initial states of this system, such that it assigns extremely low measure to the crazy microstates that we were just talking about. Okay? And it gives you a good reason, if you adopt this as a probability measure, to not worry about those crazy states, to neglect the possibility that one of those crazy states is actually the one that obtains. Okay? Like I say, I don't want to say too much about it, but there's a long debate in the foundations of statistical mechanics about whether stipulating this probability distribution over initial conditions corresponds to actually making a new empirical claim about the way the world is, writing down a new fundamental physical law, okay? Or whether it rather can be derived from some a priori principle of reasoning, like the principle of indifference that Laplace was interested in, and so on and so forth. There's a long story to tell about that. Like I said, if there are questions about it, we can tell some of that story here. But it seems to me fair to say that the upshot of that story is that it does indeed correspond to an additional fundamental physical posit. Okay. That is the lesson here, is that in the classical case, F equals MA ends up telling you, F equals MA by itself, okay, ends up telling you almost nothing about the way the world of your experience behaves, okay? Even if it were, that is, even if classical mechanics were true, F equals MA doesn't tell you that a sort of planet in its orbit isn't going to suddenly take a right turn and eject a single particle at enormously high speed in the other direction, so on and so forth. If you want to get claims like that, okay, it doesn't tell you that the block of ice isn't going to turn into a giraffe or isn't going to get larger or so on and so forth. If you want to get any claims about the way you should actually expect the world to be out of F equals MA, you need to add something to it. You need to add something in the form of a probability distribution over initial conditions. Okay? And the more, and like I say, I don't want to pretend that this is, that there's complete consensus on this and so on and so forth, but it seems to me fair to say that the more people have thought over this issue, the more it's become clear that this really amounts to an additional fundamental physical law that you need to add to something like F equals MA or to the Schrodinger equation in the quantum mechanical case in order to get actual claims about the behaviors of familiar macroscopic systems out of your theory. Okay. I'm doing everything I can to provoke people to interrupt me, and nobody's doing it. Okay. Good. Good. So here is the thought. So where does this leave us? In almost any way of making sense of quantum mechanics, in almost any way of solving the measurement problem, except for theories like GRW and CSL and so on. But say, think about Bohm's theory, think about a many worlds theory, should those turn out to make sense. Think about a collapse theory like Penrose's theory, or something like that. the fundamental structure of the world on any of these theories is going to include two completely distinct and unrelated fundamental probabilities, okay? What you might call a quantum mechanical probability, okay? The thing that's behind the truth of Born's rule, okay? And in addition to that, what you might call a statistical mechanical probability, which in the quantum mechanical case is going to take the form of a probability distribution over possible initial wave functions, okay? So that there's going to be a chance in say, Bohmian mechanics, okay? There's going to be, for each given wave function, there's going to be a probability distribution over initial positions of the particles. Okay, it's that probability distribution that's going to be behind the truth of Born's rule in Bohmian mechanics. Okay, but it's still going to be the case in Bohmian mechanics that there are going to be such things as anti-thermodynamic wave functions. Okay, there are going to be initial wave functions that you can specify that, independent of the initial position of the particle, constrain the entropy of the system to go down as time goes by, okay? The business of neglecting those is going to require an additional and unrelated fundamental probability distribution in the world, okay? A probability distribution not over particle positions given the initial wave function, but a probability distribution over the initial wave function itself, okay? And the thought about theories like GRW is that they are going to have the special property of being able to collapse these two probabilities into one. Okay? Yes?
So in classical place, you said that you needed the probability distribution of original distribution of molecules. Now, in quantum case, you said that you need the probability distribution of original wave function.
Right.
But I think that the second is much more difficult than the first, because the wave function has uncountably many degrees of freedom. So how can you really define a measure on a space with uncountably many dimensions?
Oh, there's a standard way of doing that. The way you do standard quantum statistical mechanics is instead of in the classical case, you have a volume measure in phase space. In the quantum mechanical case, that's standardly replaced with a measure of dimension of the relevant subspace of the Hilbert space. That is, in the classical case, you associate a macro state with a certain volume in the phase space, and the probability measure is associated with the standard Lebesgue measure of that volume. In the quantum mechanical case, you typically associate a macro description with a subspace of the Hilbert space. Okay, and the measure of the probability of that subspace is the dimensionality of that subspace. So this is an old story that, you know, that people did, I don't know, in the 30s or 40s, when they were getting around to applying quantum mechanics to when they were getting around to doing a quantum mechanical version of statistical mechanics. But this is a fairly established formalism. Good. So, once again, the sort of happy thought about theories like GRW is that they may have the very special property of being able to get both of these jobs done with a single probability. Here's what I mean. Go back to the standard case, and this is true both in classical statistical mechanics and in standard versions of quantum statistical mechanics. You have a block of ice on the floor. You want to explain why it's going to melt. Here's what you do. In the classical case, there are points in phase space where it's not going to melt. In the quantum mechanical case, there are vectors in the Hilbert space, in the subspace compatible with this macro state where the ice isn't going to melt. You want an excuse for ignoring those, okay? You adopt a probability measure according to which their measure, the measure of those perverse states, is very small. What's the reason you adopt that? The same as the reason you adopt any other fundamental physical law. It's empirical success. Okay. There's nothing a priori about it, as people like Laplace hoped, maybe even as people like Boltzmann and Gibbs hoped. It's empirically successful. That's why you adopt it. Okay. The thought is that in the GRW case, you're going to have the opportunity to do something different. In the GRW case, it's not hard to persuade yourself that something like the following is going to be true. Take the complete set of wave functions, the complete subspace of the Hilbert space, compatible with the macro description, there is a block of ice sitting on the floor of a warm room. Okay? Here's the claim. If you adopt the GRW dynamics, as opposed to the Schrodinger dynamics of the wave function, the following is going to be true, not just of most of the vectors in that space, not just of a set of measure one of the vectors in that space, but of every single individual vector in that space, that its probability of being melted 10 minutes from now is high, okay? And indeed is something that matches very closely the standard statistical mechanical probability of its being melted 10 minutes from now. Let me say very roughly why one should think that's true and then say it in a little more detail. Very roughly, the idea is that if it's the case that the exact microstate of the system when it starts off happens to be one of those which the deterministic Schrodinger equation would carry in an anti-thermodynamic direction, happens to be one of those which the exact Schrodinger equation would carry into a bigger chunk of ice or into a giraffe or something like that, it's overwhelmingly likely that within a relatively short time, the state of this system is going to get hit by one of these GRW collapses. Okay, that's going to knock it off of that trajectory. Okay, and a sort of random knocking it off, because those trajectories are so fantastically unstable, okay, against small perturbations. That is, because the property of being an anti-thermodynamic state is so fantastically unstable under tiny perturbations. Almost any perturbation, for example, the kind of perturbation that's introduced by the GRW theory, is going to be overwhelmingly likely to knock it onto from an anti-thermodynamic trajectory onto a thermodynamic trajectory, onto a normal thermodynamic trajectory. And moreover, the probability of being knocked from a normal thermodynamic trajectory onto an anti-thermodynamic trajectory is minuscule. Okay? So the idea is that this is a way of realizing ideas that have been floating around in the literature for many years, but which one didn't know how to make sense of without some other motivation entering into the discussion, like the measurement problem. That is, people have said for years things like, look, maybe we can explain the phenomenon of approach to equilibrium of, say, a gas in a box, okay, in terms of very small perturbations caused by interaction with its environment, okay? The trouble with these things is that you know, you could expose the intellectual bankruptcy of such approaches in just one line, okay, by saying, fine, but then redefine your system to include the environment, okay? What if it's sitting on one of the microstates that leads to anti-thermodynamic behavior for this box, okay? And you can keep going bigger and bigger and bigger until you get to the universe, and then you're out of places to go. And it's clear that this was going nowhere, okay? What's happening in the GRW theory is that this kind of perturbation is being introduced into the world not by means of interaction with some external system, but because it's built into the fundamental dynamical laws of the universe. Okay? Why are we building such a thing into the fundamental dynamical laws of the universe? We have good motivation to do so in terms of a certain way of thinking about how to solve the measurement problem. Yeah?
So all of this seems to be premised having the preferred position representation.
It's very much a feature of many attempts, you know, of basically all attempts to solve the measurement problem except Everett. So it's characteristic of GRW. It's characteristic of the broader class of spontaneous localization theories. It's characteristic of Bohmian mechanics that position space plays a special role,
but
for sure.
The identification in class mechanics of your unlikely trajectories is
right.
Premised on the identification of preferred position representation.
Oh, let's see. I'm not sure why that's the case. That is, the space I'm thinking about in the classical case is phase space, not configuration space.
I understand.
Uh-huh.
But your configuration space is very well defined in the classical case. So,
right.
So your position representation is a given in that case, whereas in quantum mechanics, it's not necessarily.
Right. I'm just wondering why, in what sense it's preferred in the, you mean preferred over a momentum space representation or preferred over what?
Or some mixed representation.
Right. But in the classical case, I mean, there may be nothing at stake here, so maybe it's not worth arguing about, but I'm not sure I get what you're saying in the classical case.
So I'm wondering to what extent all of this argument is contingent on identifying a preferred position representation. Which is, in a sense, saying that we have no measurement problem to start with.
Gee, the second part of that, it seems to me, I radically disagree with. Merely writing things down choosing to write things down in the position basis doesn't do anything to solve this problem. That is, it doesn't get rid of either one of these branches of the wave function. In order to do that, you need to actually, doing that is not a matter of choosing which representation to write down the wave function in. It's a matter of actually altering the laws of the evolution in time of the wave function, okay? So to say that once we've chosen to write things down in a position representation, we don't have a measurement problem anymore, this I don't understand at all. You write things down in a position representation precisely because, in the context of the Schrodinger equation, the position representation is equivalent to any other representation. You get this superposition in the end, okay? And it's the existence of this superposition that causes the problem. And the GRW theory is proposing modifications of the actual equations of motion that are aimed at getting rid of this superposition and replacing it by this sum of the time and this sum of the time. None of that is achieved by simply deciding to write things down in the position representation. Yeah?
Could you spend a couple of minutes reviewing the highlights of GRW?
Sure. The highlights of GRW. There's one. Let's see. Here are the highlights of GRW. Let me do it in a sort of quick and dirty way. Think of a single particle, okay? Here are the rules of the evolution of a single particle according to GRW. Its wave function evolves in accord with the Schrodinger equation, except, okay, that every now and then, okay, at times that are chosen at random, that is, that have nothing to do with the shape of the wave function or anything like that, they have no physical triggers, okay? At times that are chosen at random, but which have a fixed probability per unit time for this particle, and the probability is very, very, very low, okay? Per particle, what is it? In the original theory, on average, once in 10 to the 12th years or something like that? Somebody must know this. 10 to the 9th years? It's a long time, okay? It's a long time. Once in every 10 to the 12th, 10 to the 9th years, okay, at a randomly chosen moment, whatever the wave function is, gets multiplied by a Gaussian, okay? So there are two new constants of nature involved in this theory. One, the probability per particle per unit time of one of these multiplications. Two, the width of these multiplying Gaussians. Okay. The only thing that remains to tell you in order to have the laws completely specified is what determines the location in space of the center of this Gaussian. Okay. And the rule is, as I've just been corrected here, that the probability of this Gaussian's being centered at any particular point in space, okay, is equal to the inner product of between a Gaussian centered at that point in space and the wave function of the particle, whatever it was, immediately before this multiplication. Okay? And it's from that that you get the truth of something like the Born rule. Okay? That is, this is likely to be localized. Okay? This is more likely to be localized in those places where the Born rule says you'd be more likely to find it if you were to go look. Okay? But of course, none of this has anything to do with looking. This is a process that just happens as a matter of fundamental physical law every now and then, whether anybody's looking or not. Okay, good. Now, first piece of good news. For systems consisting of small numbers of elementary particles, this has almost no effect because it basically never happens. Okay, it's very, very rare per particle. Good. But suppose you have a pointer, okay, or some other macroscopic object which is in a superposition of being here and here. So that constitutes, on the micro level, an entangled state, okay, that looks like this. It's a superposition of alpha, x1 for particle 1, x2 for x1 for particle 2. X1 for particle 3, dot, 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 plus beta, X2 for particle 1, X2 for particle 2, X2 for particle 3, dot, 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 okay? Where X1 is you know, the approximate macroscopic location here, and X2 is the approximate macroscopic location here. And this entangled superposition represents a superposition of two physical situations, in one of which the macroscopic body is in its entirety over here, and in the other of which the macroscopic body is in its entirety over there. Good. And the thought is, suppose that particle number 3 gets hit by one of these collapses, and the collapse it's hit by happens to be centered near X1 rather than X2. Okay? Because of the geometry of the Hilbert space, okay, because of the way you write things down, that is going to multiply not only this term by zero, but multiplying this term by zero is multiplying this whole second term of the wave function by zero. It's going to suddenly snap the macro body into place at x1. That's what's so cool about this theory. Okay? It does almost nothing where you want it to do nothing. It does a hell of a lot where you want it to do a hell of a lot. Where do you want it to do a hell of a lot? When you're confronted with superpositions of macroscopic objects being in two different spatial locations. Those are the things you're allergic to. Those are the things you want to get rid of as fast as you can. This gets rid of them fast.
And what is the agent multiplying by the Gaussian?
It's a fundamental law. This is a claim about how. Now, there are all kinds of elaborations on this, right? In CSL, which Philip developed, you have a more elaborate dynamical picture of what's going on, but as a logical matter, there are lots of things to be said pro and con, I think, for going in these different directions. But let me stick for the moment with the original GRW theory. The position of the original GRW theory is, this is a fundamental law, okay? There's no more sense to asking about the mechanism or the agency of this collapse than there is to asking about the mechanism whereby F equals ma turns out to be true in classical mechanics. It's a fundamental law, okay? It's the point where explanation in terms of mechanisms comes to an end, okay? It's posited as a new fundamental law. This is the way wave functions evolve. They don't evolve in accord with the Schrodinger equation. They evolve in accord with the Schrodinger equation with this collapse process superimposed on top of it. That's stipulated to be the fundamental laws of the evolution of the wave function period, end of story. Of course, as with everything, as with F equals MA, everybody is always or ought always to have the attitude that if somebody comes to us with a deeper and prettier and simpler account of why something like F equals MA should be true, we'll be delighted, okay, as we would be here. But it's also the case that F equals MA could conceivably be just the form of the fundamental law about which there's no more to say, and one can take this attitude towards this collapse mechanism as well. Okay, that is, unlike older talk about the collapse, things that had to do with vague English words like measurement or macroscopicness or something like that, this has the virtue of being completely explicit, okay? Completely mathematically precise and explicit. There aren't any words that you need to use in the formulation of this theory, words like measurement or macroscopic or subject or object or something like that, that seem unfit to play a role in a fully precise fundamental scientific theory, okay? So maybe these are just the fundamental laws. If somebody proposes a deeper explanation of their truth, as I said, everyone reasonable is going to be delighted, okay? But maybe there is a deeper explanation, maybe there's not. Yeah.
Regarding this issue of the a priori probabilistic distributions,
yeah,
one, or the measure, as you call it,
yeah,
would it be fair to say that one is transferring that problem into the that measure, is using that measure as part of the
description
of probabilities that you are
I don't understand. Once upon a time, and this, as far as I know, goes back to Laplace, okay? Once upon a time, people used to talk like this, okay? If all I know about a certain situation is that either the marble is in box A or the marble is in box B, and I know that it's in one of the boxes, but I have no clue further than that about its location, okay? People used to say, and this practice was codified under the term principle of indifference, people used to say it is irrational to do anything other than assigning equal 50% probability to its being in the first box or 50% probability to its being in the second box. Here's the argument, roughly. Any other assignment of probabilities would be violating the symmetries that are implicit in how you yourself describe your epistemic situation. Your epistemic situation, the correct description of your epistemic situation is, I have no clue, okay? And there's only one assignment, that I have no clue makes no distinction between box one and box two. There's only one possible assignment of probabilities that respects that symmetry. Okay, that's the 50-50 assignment of probabilities. Therefore, the only rational thing to do under those circumstances is assign 50-50 probabilities. Good. This, I think, is how people thought at the end of the 19th century about the probabilities in statistical mechanics. They weren't additional stipulations. They were just translations into mathematical language of the claim that I know this is the macro state, and as to the micro, which one of the micro states obtains that's consistent with that macro state, I have no clue. Okay? Good. There are two problems with this. There's a technical problem and a conceptual problem. The technical problem, which is quite famous, is that unfortunately, especially in cases of a continuous number of available states like you have in statistical mechanics, there's an infinite number of different measures that you could put on such a set. Okay, there isn't just one. That is, there's an infinite number of different ways of counting up how many different possible situations are compatible with the macro state. Okay, there isn't a unique way of counting them up. Okay, so this principle that Laplace advocated of giving equal probability to each of the elementary possibilities just doesn't make sense because there isn't a unique way of counting up the elementary possibilities. There are many different measures you can put on any continuously infinite set of points. Second issue, okay, there's just a mistake in Laplace's argument, okay? There's another thing you can do which respects the symmetries inherent in your epistemic situation, a more reasonable thing to do, which is to say, which is to refrain from assigning probabilities at all, okay? Which is to say to the guy who asks you what's the probability, the correct answer to this guy is not it must be 50-50 because that's the only thing that respects the symmetries of my epistemic situation. The correct answer is which part of I have no clue do you not understand, okay? I have no clue, okay? I don't know which box it's in. Nobody told me which box it's in. I have no basis for assigning a probability to its being in this box or to its being in that box. If I open many such boxes, half the time it ends up in this box, half the time it ends up in that box, then I have good empirical rather than a priori grounds, okay? I have good empirical grounds for assigning a probability distribution over the initial conditions. That's what's going on, I think people claim, in statistical mechanics. That's what's also going on in GRW. Once you understand this to be an empirical matter, like other empirical matters, once you understand these probabilistic claims to be empirical laws or consequences of empirical laws, rather than a priori things, then everything is fine. Okay, then you understand what probabilistic locutions mean. I must be almost out of time, or I must be more than out of time.
You know, you have 10 minutes, but you started late.
Okay, so does that help?
Yes, I would say then that you're saying that we choose this particular law with this particular problem.
Because it's empirically successful. Of course, but why does anybody, I mean, people say, people, you know, I agree with every word you said, I just disagree with your tone of voice, okay, right? Like there was something else we ever did in science, okay? That is, people say, oh, you've chosen this just because it gives the correct empirical predictions. Duh, you know? I mean, that's what you do in science, okay? Yes, of course that's why we chose that probability. Also because there's a simple and elegant way of formulating it. It has all the things we want of a successful scientific theory. It's simple, it's clean, it's empirically successful, okay? Okay, say a punchline and then if there's time for questions, I'll be glad. So look, here's the punchline. Here's what's so cool about theories like GRW. If one of these theories should turn out to be true, and this once again is an empirical matter, okay, the collapse theories make different predictions from non-collapse theories like Bohmian mechanics or something like that. We heard a lot about that from Angelo yesterday. So the arbiter at the end of the day here is going to be experiment. But if it should turn out to be empirically true that these theories are right, then the number of fundamental principles we need in physics is going to be reduced by one in a very beautiful way. If theories like this turn out to be true, it's going to be the case that all of the probabilities in the world, both the quantum mechanical probabilities and the statistical mechanical probabilities, okay, are going to turn out to be traceable. You know, it's the Born rule, as it were, that's doing all the probabilistic work there is to be done in the world if one of these theories turns out to be true. So there's a really dramatic simplification and unification of what looked like completely disparate parts of physics available should one of these theories turn out to be true. Good, thanks.